From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the aftermath of the terrorist bombing in Oklahoma City. From Oklahoma City, we talk with Patrick McGuigan, editorial page editor for the Daily Oklahoman. We'll discuss the community's response to the tragedy. We'll consider the psychological impact of terrorism with Robert J. Lifton, an expert on mass social trauma. And we'll discuss how the FBI goes about gathering clues about a bombing with David Fisher, author of Hard Evidence, an inside account of the FBI criminal laboratory. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. In Oklahoma City, the FBI agent on the scene in charge of the car bombing investigation says investigators have identified a rented truck they believe held the explosive used in the attack. Agent Weldon Kennedy says arrest warrants are being issued for two men connected with that vehicle. Kennedy says the warrants are being issued based on descriptions and that the men's names are not known. He says the men should be considered armed and extremely dangerous. Authorities say that Britain has returned a man to the U.S. who may be a witness or a suspect in the Oklahoma City car bombing. The British Home Office says it had been alerted by American officials and refused the man entry at Heathrow Airport. A Home Office spokeswoman identifies the man as a possible suspect, but a Justice Department official says the man may be a witness and is not under arrest. James Lee Witt, the director of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, is in Oklahoma City overseeing emergency operations. He says a thorough search is continuing for anyone left alive in the bombed-out federal building.
Highly special equipment that they have, the very sensitive equipment, like the little mini cameras that goes in the cracks and crevices and looks, and also the sensitive hearing equipment they have that they can go down in these cracks and listen.
At one point today, that search was suspended because of fears that more of the building would collapse, but the teams have gone back in again. The official death count remains at 36, with officials expecting to find many more bodies in the collapsed structure. NPR's Cheryl Duvall has more from Oklahoma City.
The death toll is expected to rise. However, there is a little bit of good news in this. All night long, all of yesterday and all night long, there has been a telephone number broadcast pretty frequently on television and radio here, asking people to call in if they were in the building at the time. At this point, about 700 people have, and that suggests that the number of unaccounted people, which has been about 200, everyone's saying, may be lower than that.
NPR's Cheryl Duvall in Oklahoma City. Athens police say a man blew up a hand grenade today, killing himself and a high-ranking Greek Navy officer at the officer's home. Police say the attacker was a foreign language teacher, and he used a grenade similar to those used by Greek terrorist groups. But police can't say whether it was a guerrilla or a criminal attack. Police say the attacker went to the Navy officer's house and detonated the grenade when the door opened. From Wall Street, unofficial tallies indicate the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 26.28 points to close at 4233.77. Advancing issues led declines by a slight margin. This is NPR. The UN says Bosnian Serbs blocked flights into Sarajevo Airport again today, even though the Speaker of the Bosnian Serb Assembly had guaranteed that the airport could reopen. A UN spokesman says a Bosnian Serb liaison officer looked at a passenger list for a plane due to land, objected to civilians aboard, and withdrew promises that the flight could land safely. The Serbs have kept the airport shut down for 3 days in violation of a 1992 agreement that the UN can operate the airport without harassment. When the Serbs refuse to guarantee the safety of a plane, the UN takes that as a warning the plane will be shot at, and several have been. Egypt says it's beginning a series of flights sanctioned by the United Nations to ferry Muslim pilgrims from Libya to Saudi Arabia. NPR's Suni Khalid reports from Cairo.
Libyans celebrated their successful defiance of a U.N. air travel ban the day after a Libyan air jetliner flew to Saudi Arabia. Saudi authorities said a Libyan Arab Airlines jet landed in the city of Jeddah yesterday. The flight, bringing about 150 Libyan pilgrims for the annual Hajj religious pilgrimage, made good a threat by Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi to violate a three-year U.N. ban on air travel to and from Libya. The Libyan jetliner took off from the capital, Tripoli, just before the United Nations Sanctions Committee decided to authorize 45 Egypt Air flights to transport 5,000 Libyan pilgrims to Mecca. The UN Security Council imposed a ban on travel against Libya for that country's alleged involvement in the downing of Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland in 1988. I'm Suni Khalid in Cairo.
Moscow is denying reports that the Kremlin has ordered Russian troops in Chechnya to stop fighting the rebels. The official news agency TASS had said the reported ceasefire was linked to the impending arrival of world leaders for the 50th anniversary celebrations on the end of World War II in Europe, but an Interior Ministry spokeswoman says the troops have not been ordered to stop fighting. I'm Barbara Campbell in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As the editorial page editor of the Daily Oklahoman in Oklahoma City, Patrick McGuigan is trying to find the words that can express the magnitude of yesterday's terrorist bombing. McGuigan was born in Oklahoma City and has lived there most of his life. His paper's offices are about 8.5 miles from the federal building that was bombed yesterday. He was in the elevator when the bomb went off, and all he felt was a slight tremor. But ever since that moment, he's been dealing with the impact of the bombing on the life of his community and his family. We called him to talk about the community's response to the bombing. I asked him first about writing the editorial that was published in today's paper.
It is as difficult as any assignment, I guess I could imagine, would be trying to figure out exactly what to say in the wake of something so monumental. Simply describing what's going on is difficult enough. But then to try to say, okay, here's what it means, here's context, because you don't know exactly what it means. You don't know what the context is. It's so unimaginable. There is literally nothing like this has ever happened in our state, although we are a place that is known somewhat deservedly, you know, for a variety of natural, incredible natural phenomenon. We're part of Tornado Alley, of course. And particularly in the dry late summers, horrific grass fires are very common. We had the incredible depression of the 1980s in the oil industry that shattered our economy for a time. And 1930s, of course, this was the home of the Dust Bowl. So we're used to cataclysms and natural disasters. But this is not a natural disaster. This is a crime of unbelievable intensity. So there was a great deal of thought given as to how that could, you know, possibly be expressed, and so with quite a bit of restraint, we just talk about the simple reality of 1 minute, a normal day in downtown Oklahoma City, and the next minute, a cataclysm. But then we simply describe the way that Oklahomans responded.
What are some of the responses you've been seeing?
Extremely impressive. Well, within an hour of the disaster, first of all, the initial response is among the more amazing things one could ever expect to see in life. People who were nearby, driving in their cars for whatever reason on their way to work elsewhere in town, or you know, arriving in downtown for work, diverted to the area of the disaster. And it was they, not the ambulance personnel, who got many of the injured survivors initially to hospitals. They just stopped, pulled up, opened their door, and said, "Get in, I'll get you to St. Anthony's, or I'll get you to Mercy, or one of the other hospitals." Again, hard to articulate. People not as seriously injured. Some of those who picked them up had the foresight, if you will, to understand, well, St. Anthony's, which is just blocks away, they're going to be swamped, so, you know, you're bleeding, but it's not immediately life-threatening. I'll get you to Midwest City Regional, which is about, you know, 12, 13 miles away, and then they did that. so you begin with that, and then it ripples out. A call was issued, of course, for the emergency system to go into place, and physicians who were on staff at hospitals and so forth knew how to respond. But then that was exponentially increased by retired physicians and nurses getting in their vehicles and driving to within a mile or so of downtown because the area had begun to be cordoned off, and walking in and treating people on street corners, climbing into, you know, some of the buildings where the glass was broken from the explosion to make sure there wasn't anybody left, you know, to find other people. And then it just keeps going. All over the metropolitan area, at every blood bank, lines stretched for blocks.
What role is the newspaper trying to play in the lives of its readers right now?
We're just, my colleagues in the newsroom have done an incredible job yesterday and late into last night, capturing individual stories as well as putting enough information together about, you know, the whole picture. The lead stories, of course, were an attempt to do that, to just say, here's when it happened, here's what's known so far, the numbers, which, of course, are mounting in terms of dead, several hundred names of known victims who were injured, not fatalities, but people injured, treated at hospitals and released or held, and, you know, the status of their condition. People wanted to know all the information they possibly could, of a sort that can't necessarily be provided by television because of a difference in resources. And our newspaper did that in this morning's editions, and we'll do it again tomorrow. Individual stories, in addition to that big picture I just described, a couple dozen vignettes, individual stories of people, what they were doing at the moment, things exploded around them, how they responded, those who helped them, and then the other side of that story, stories of the individual fire and police and medical rescue workers, people who were driving by on the interstate who diverted into downtown and just went to work doing what they could to help. That's what we captured in today's editions.
Do you personally have any friends or family who were trapped in the building?
The chief executive officer of the Federal Employees Credit Union is a longtime friend of our family. She survived. She was on the third floor in a meeting with her staff, and the floor completely collapsed under them. By last night, she had reconstructed in her mind that she had seen 30 of the staff. I don't know how big the staff is total. Only 12 are accounted for as of sometime this morning. And that gives you a feel for what the potential, what we all fear is happening, you know, as more bodies are brought out. Just over a third of that particular office. There's another lady who I've been making deposits with. I'm not a federal employee, but my father was a career federal employee, and he co-founded this particular credit union, so I've retained my lifelong membership there. And the lady I regularly make deposits with, we can't figure out if she's made it or not, and things are still relatively fluid, and so there's, you know, some hope that perhaps she did. My father is very grief-stricken that we've not lost a member of our family, but these people at the credit union Some of them he's known for about half of his life, and he's in his 60s. So you can just magnify that kind of impact and then go directly to people who have family that their bodies have not been found, but they're, of course, right now living with the presumption that they're dead.
What kind of questions are you asking yourself today about why this happened and who did it?
Well, it's very hard to provide the most frequent question asked by friends in the news business who are calling from around the country is, what does it mean? How are you dealing with it? And I think people are dealing with it remarkably well. The most difficult time will be in the next several days when there's going to be, a couple hundred funerals, more than you would have in a, quote, normal, unquote, cycle of 2 or 3 days. So those are the questions are not, why? I mean, it's obvious why. There's a group or groups who felt they could achieve something for their political or other objectives by doing this, and it just is unfathomable that they could conceive that such a thing would be effective in an actual sense. I mean, it just the initial thought of everyone is and still here on the second day is for the tragedy and for the people and for figuring out who's been lost and comforting one another and helping one another and still donating blood and going on. The meaning of it all, quote unquote, is not something people are talking about too much.
Are people in Oklahoma City just astonished that their city was chosen for this act of terrorism?
Yes. I mean, that's probably the most frequently heard comment, even here in Oklahoma City, where one of the reasons people like it here is that although this is a large metropolitan area, the city is about 500,000. The metropolitan area is 1.5 million. We're about a third of the population of the state is here, within a short, area, short distance drive. But still, this part of the world, the crime rate's less than most big metro areas, although crime's a problem. People, particularly in the leadership, tend to know each other. There's a sense of community, even across political lines. The divide, if you will, is not nearly as pronounced between political extremes as it is in the nation's capital. And so there's a sense of community, and that has been dramatically enhanced over what already existed by people's behavior in the last 36 hours. But the enormity of the loss is still, I have to say, I mean, I think that is still setting in. And so there's still a lot of care and love, the only word, that's going to be needed by everybody, particularly those who have these direct losses themselves.
My guest is Patrick McGuigan. He's editorial page editor of the Daily Oklahoman in Oklahoma City. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Patrick McGuigan, editorial page editor of the Daily Oklahoman in Oklahoma City. How is the city functioning today? Are people going to work? Are they staying home? Or Are stores open? Are offices open?
Yes. You should understand, of course, the damage is all in a particular area, although windows were shattered up to several miles away in some instances. So people are repairing the damage. All the highways are open except right there in the heart of downtown. People are doing very practical things, contributing to the Red Cross, calling in and getting on lists of volunteers to be called when the people already working get tired. Folks are taking out their checkbooks and, you know, sending to the Red Cross, the Salvation Army, the blood banks, groups like Feed the Children, which is known internationally but and is based here. But, you know, now they're having to work on. And they have in the past worked on tornadoes and issues, things like that here in Oklahoma, but now they're working on a Bosnia-type situation right here in our town. So, yes, people are functioning. It's very, it's the topic on everybody's mind. But people are functioning and going about their business in the context of providing whatever help they can in addition to daily tasks.
Do you have children?
I have four.
How did you talk with them about the explosion and particularly about all the children who were killed? I mean, are you, I don't know how old your children are.
We managed to have dinner together last night, and we just hugged each other, and we held hands around the table and said our traditional blessing over the food, and then we just talked about it. Very straightforward. In our case, we have a lot of regular interaction and communication with the kids, even in the midst of a very busy life, and so they were very disturbed, worried about kids that might still be in there. Heartsick. We all went to, I shouldn't say we all, my wife and I, our daughter, my mom and dad, all went to the church service last night at the cathedral, which attracted a few hundred people just to pray. It was a regular mass service with a much bigger crowd than normal. And the pastor analogized the experience of those left behind to the disciples of Jesus, left behind after his execution, his death, and called on all of us to love one another and to trust in God and to ask God for comfort. And he also made a particular point of saying that of asking God in a prayer not to let our hearts be hardened by what's happened. And I don't think there's any doubt that people's hearts have not been hardened about the situation. I think there will understandably be some mounting anger about the people who did this and a determination to bring them to justice.
Are your children home today, or did
no,
they?
No, most the a lot of what am I trying to say? Athletic events and things like that. Not all, but many such activities have been canceled or postponed for several days. The Associated Press event in Tulsa, you know, the local journalism awards for our region. Have been postponed from this weekend. My kids are at school. A lot of schools still met. Some parents held their children home from school to spend time with them. A few schools are not having classes, but most people you know, just kind of grit their teeth and went on and then are trying to figure out ways to be helpful even while they go on. So it's a simultaneous process of providing the comfort and living, surviving. Oklahoma, you hear expressions like Oklahoma is a state of survivors, and that refers to the fact of our dramatic weather, and it refers to, you know, kind of the gritty determination of the farmers and ranchers that predominated in our history. Now most people do live in Oklahoma City or Tulsa, but most people have connections and roots to the land. So that expression, you know, a state of survivors, is encapsulates all of that. We're hearing that a lot today, and it takes on a much, you know, even deeper meaning than it had 2 days ago.
Have you gotten any sleep since the explosion?
Yes, I did sleep 5 or 6 hours. I stayed until the first edition was out, the one that goes out into the far reaches of the state and into Kansas, the first edition, to read it. And then I went home because, you know, I really had a lot of nervous energy, and I got stuff done, made some preparation for, you know, what I'm going to be doing in the next few days, writing about this, kind of organized things. I did practical stuff while having the television on and scrolling stories by my colleagues as they were filed. Then went home and said my prayers and went to bed and got up early and got with it again.
Do you have your editorial planned yet for tomorrow?
Yes. This was my colleague, J.E. McReynolds, wrote this, and it will be the lead tomorrow. The title is Pray for the Peace of Our City. It can't happen here. The words keep echoing through our minds. It can't happen here, but it can and it did. Time and life go on, but the calendar page for April 19th, 1995 cannot be torn from our memories. Now that we know it can happen here, in Middle America, away from the centers of influence, the whole nation grieves its loss of security. The whole nation, indeed the entire world, bows in sorrow and shock over what happened Wednesday in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. It goes on from there. It encourages people to pray. Says that it's a time for the city and nation to draw nearer to God and to pray for the peace of Oklahoma City, as well as the peace of Jerusalem and Beirut and all the other places where terrorism routinely strikes fear into the hearts of good people.
Well, Patrick McGuigan, I'll let you get back to the paper. I'm sure you're really busy today. I want to thank you very much for your time with us.
Okay. You all take good care.
Patrick McGuigan is editorial page editor of the Daily Oklahoman in Oklahoma City. We spoke early this afternoon. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The Oklahoma City bombing has made us all feel more vulnerable to terrorist attacks. Coming up, we discuss the psychological impact of terrorism with Robert J. Lifton, an expert on mass social trauma. Also, searching for clues, we talk with David Fisher about how the FBI investigates bombings and collects evidence that will lead them to the killers. Fisher wrote about the explosive experts who investigated the World Trade Center bombing in his book Hard Evidence. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Something has changed about life in America. After yesterday's terrorist bombing and the World Trade Center bombing, we feel more vulnerable. Robert J. Lifton is an expert on the effect of mass social trauma. He studied the survivors of Hiroshima. During the Cold War, he wrote a pioneering work about the fear and numbing caused by living in a world with nuclear weapons. He's also written about the psychology of people who commit war crimes. In one of his books, he created a psychological portrait of Nazi doctors. He's also studied cult groups and their leaders. Lifton directs the Center on Violence and Human Survival at the City University of New York John Jay College, where he's a distinguished professor of psychiatry and psychology. I asked him about the unique psychological impact of terrorism.
It's sudden. It comes from the outside. It's not an act of nature or God, and it's not anything one can prepare for. It also is perceived as something done with malice toward oneself, one's own people. All those things, I think, create a very strong impact, and that's especially true in the United States, where terrorism from the outside is new.
And what do you do with all the anxiety that an act of terrorism causes? I mean, sure, you can seek counseling or something, but that's not going to make the reality of the fear go away, the reality of...
Yes, well, there are two levels, of course. One is the immediate experience of survivors, and they can seek counseling, and they have, you know, more or less classical patterns of psychology of the survivor, post-traumatic symptoms, and various forms of anxiety, which we know about and which it's very important to attend to. But then there's a larger dimension, which has to do with a wave of collective anxiety that reverberates far beyond the actual event and really affects all of us, affects Americans in general. It's anxiety, and it's a new sense of vulnerability, which hadn't been there before.
Do you think that the impact and the symbolic meaning of the bombing of the World Trade Center is different from what happened yesterday in Oklahoma City?
Well, they're similar, but the bombing of the World Trade Center in New York City, it was a stunning blow also, because they both mean vulnerability. America is no longer protected by its oceans or by its military predominance. We're vulnerable like other countries. But there's a difference between New York City and Oklahoma City in that regard. You expect New York City to be more provocative, more vulnerable, more involved in any potential for terror. You don't expect that of Oklahoma City, which signifies the American heartland. The idea, the feeling that Americans have, I'm sure, is that if Oklahoma City can be targeted so effectively, nobody's safe anywhere in this country. And in that sense, there's a big difference. There's also a difference in the sense that this was the second major act of terrorism of this kind. And the first act you might be able to take in and dismiss as a single episode. If it's done a second time on an even greater scale, it sinks in that this can happen now. It's something we're vulnerable to. It's a new dimension of threat. And that's what Americans are struggling to take in now.
I think it's hard for anybody to distance themselves now It would have been easy for people outside of New York to say, well, it happens in a place like that. I don't live in a place like that.
Exactly. Exactly, because often you can kind of differentiate New York City or any large American city from the rest of America, from the heartland, and say these are two different cultures. Actually, the differences are exaggerated. The similarities that we all have as Americans are greater than these distinctions, I often feel. And in this case, it's no longer possible to do. It's a sense of a new vulnerability, and we're just beginning to think about what this means. Americans never feared terrorism from the outside. We will now begin to fear it, and that means no matter what happens now, and even if this subsides and there's no, as one hopes, additional episode of this kind in the near future, something has happened. Some new image is now in our psyches, and it has to do with threat, and even when we're not thinking about it, it's there so it can be stimulated if something else comes up. It's, you know, when the atomic bombs were dropped, it was a new image that hit the world of something that could happen, and if one didn't think about it, it was still there to be reactivated if something stimulated again. It's that way now with America's vulnerability to terrorism.
Dr. Lifton, you work in New York City. Did you feel personally vulnerable after the World Trade Center bombing?
I did indeed. Right after the World Trade Center bombing, we talked about it in my family, among friends. We all felt a wave of vulnerability, and I personally felt I'm not completely safe. Something can happen that can injure me or people very close to me, and we're just as vulnerable as, in some sense, people in the Middle East or in Europe, in France, in the Far East. It's a world phenomenon, and once one felt that way, it'll never go away. It's a new existential state of being.
Did the World Trade Center bombing change your behavior in any way?
It didn't change my behavior in any discernible external way. I still went about my everyday activities and my work, but it became part of everything. It was a new signal that life isn't so safe. You know, I often quote an interview I had with a man who survived Auschwitz, and after sitting in his comfortable study, it was in Haifa, Israel, he said to me at the end of our interview, "This world is not this world." And what I think he meant by that was that once you've known a profound menace, in his case Auschwitz, you know that no matter how safe things seem, how comfortable they seem, there is that menace that lies underneath. In a lesser way, I and everybody else in New York experienced that after the World Trade Center bombing, and now I think all Americans have some of that feeling that this world is not this world and that there is that potential menace that lies underneath.
My guest is Dr. Robert J. Lifton. He directs the Center on Violence and Human Survival at the City University of New York at John Jay College. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is psychiatrist and psychologist, Dr. Robert J. Lifton. You've done some really fascinating studies, in the past few years, and one of your studies was about Nazi doctors. I'm wondering if you ever try to enter the mind of a terrorist. I mean, you can't help but ask yourself, after the bombing in Oklahoma City, how can a human being bomb a place where not only are civilians working, there's a daycare center inside?
Yes. That's the kind of question everybody quite understandably asks, and the beginning answer I'd give to that is something like the doubling, the formation of what's a functional second self, which I observed in Nazi doctors, but there's lots of evidence of it in terrorists also, so that these same terrorists might be ordinary sons, husbands, fathers most of the time, and yet they can commit themselves to a terrorist self which doesn't see the children, doesn't put before their own imagination helpless human beings, and especially young children, but only a certain larger goal for their movement. And a terrorist always sees good in the violence that he or she perpetrates, a larger good. And that second self carries out the function that's expected. And in that way, one can do all kinds of violent things and be a very ordinary, nonviolent human being most of the time.
Is part of that double self believing that there's no such thing as innocence anymore, that that everybody is somehow implicated in your own suffering?
One has the idea that one's own group has suffered, it suffered unjustly, and one has to take drastic action in order to punish those who have caused the suffering, but also liberate one's own people. And it moves to an extreme. Any action becomes justified. It's an absolute polarization, a kind of inner separation of elements of the psyche between good and evil. But one sees oneself as doing something good, necessary, and virtuous. That's the irony of it. And I don't think we can understand terrorism or large-scale killing, even genocide, without grasping that.
Do you worry in times like this that an act of terrorism will be used by other people to rationalize expressing their anger through violence?
You mean retribution?
Retribution,
against,
yeah.
Against these terrorists.
Well, a retribution against people who they think might be like these terrorists, these terrorists' ethnic group, or these terrorists...
I worry about that a great deal. I mean, I think that's a very important question, and it might not be the most popular question to ask right now when Americans are so upset and understandably so enraged. But we do have to ask that question because violence begets violence. It's a very fundamental principle of human behavior. There is a powerful impulse which all of us share to do something violent to the people who did this really evil act, as Clinton said. But having said that, one has to seek to be wiser. We need a collective survivor meaning from this experience, which has to do with punishing those responsible, but also looking to the causes and doing all we can to replace an atmosphere of violence with one of nonviolence. If you look at the peace process in the Middle East, that's what one sees, and you know, it's possible, though we don't know, that this event is related to that process in some way. Forces of violence, whether they come from extremist Palestinian groups or extremist Israeli groups, seek to maintain a climate of violence that prevents a peace process, and they seek to provoke violence.
What are you going to be looking at in the next few days or weeks in the aftermath of the bombing?
Well, I'm going to be looking at two or three different aspects. One is the traditional but very important aspect of what's happening to the people in Oklahoma City and those most directly affected and to their families, and that will be a considerable wave of pain, anxiety, and post-traumatic effects. I'm going to be looking at the reverberations of anxiety and anger all through the American population, what that means, how we feel as Americans, how we deal with our sudden quantum jump in vulnerability and fear, because that's going to affect us, and it's going to take on important effects over the next weeks. And I'm also going to be looking at what our leaders, what our political leaders will be doing. Will they, as one fears, be tempted to exploit this and reassert American virtue and really the virtue of the particular policy there behind in relation to terror or the Middle East or American government in general? Or will they show some further sensitivity about investigating the sources of this violence, looking at American policy perhaps more wisely, more reflectively, to see how it might take a direction that would minimize and isolate these acts of violence rather than perpetuate them with acts in kind.
Dr. Lifton, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks very much.
Robert J. Lifton is a professor of psychiatry and psychology at the City University of New York and John Jay College. His latest book is called The Protean Self, Human Resilience in the Age of Fragmentation. His next book, Hiroshima in America, will be published in July. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what do you have on Oklahoma City?
Hi, Terry. We'll have reporters from Oklahoma City telling us about the latest rescue efforts there. And I'll be talking with a security expert about his theories of super terrorism around the world. We'll have the latest of the investigation from an official Washington perspective. Also, this note, Milovan Gilas has died in Belgrade, Yugoslavia. He fought with Tito's partisans. He was part of the government later. And then he turned against Tito and against communism and went to prison for his dissent. Also, Linda Wertheimer talks with Carol Guzzi, Washington Post news photographer. Yesterday, she won the Pulitzer Prize.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The FBI has some extraordinary techniques to track down terrorists. David Fisher writes about the FBI Criminal Laboratory in his new book, Hard Evidence. The investigations he followed in the book include the bombings of the World Trade Center and Pan Am Flight 103. I asked Fisher how the FBI connects the evidence at the bomb site to a suspect.
Well, you know, a bomb is a weapon, just like a gun or anything else. And eventually what you do in any criminal investigation is you connect the suspect to the weapon. And that's how you get a conviction. In order to commit a crime, you have to go to a crime scene. You have to have the materials that you need to commit the crime. All of these things are the kind of things that are used to connect a suspect to a bomb. I mean, there's endless ways they can do it. In the World Trade Center, for example, the day after the World Trade Center bombing, the New York Times received a letter from someone claiming credit for the bombing and threatening further bombings, and they were able to extract DNA from the saliva used to seal the letter. And when they did identify a suspect, they were able to, by getting his DNA, prove he'd written the letter, and then go into his computer and find the letter. And in fact, that was the only hard evidence against that particular conspirator. And it'll be the same thing in this case. What they're doing now is they're setting up a perimeter, and they're going to go inch by inch through that building, and eventually every bit of debris is going to go through some sort of screening device. And they're going to find as much of that bomb as they possibly can find. And those are the bits and pieces that they're going to use to pin these people to the crime. I mean, they had to buy the fertilizer somewhere. That fertilizer...
The fertilizer for the bomb.
Fertilizer for the bomb. They may well be fingerprints. They often find fingerprints on batteries and things like that which survive a bombing. There are 15 units in the FBI crime lab. And I guarantee you, every one of those units is working on this day and night at this point. Not just the explosives unit is the lead unit, and they're on the site and they're running it. But eventually, you're going to get the chemistry people in there. You're going to get the identification people in there. The FBI has a very unique unit known as the Disaster Squad, and their job is simply to go to places like this, and as awful as it sounds, pick up body parts and identify who they came from and give a name to a corpse and let them be buried with dignity. So the lab is in, I'm sure, 100% action. Every person in that lab is working on this case today.
After an explosion like yesterday's in Oklahoma City, where does the FBI begin to try to figure out what kind of bomb caused it?
Bombs leave very specific results. Different explosives detonate at different speeds, and the pressure wave causes different amounts of damage. Certain explosives cause a pressure wave that goes 1,000 feet a second, for example, that will do different damage to steel girders than explosives that explode at a lesser rate. The experts, by looking at the damage, the type of damage, to steel, to masonry, to glass, can tell you about the speed, about the type of explosive that was used. Once they identify the type of explosive from the amount of damage, they can tell you how large a bomb it was. One of the things that the FBI explosive lab does is they blow things up, and they blow them up a lot. After Pan Am 103 blew up, what they did is they rebuilt bombs. They found residue, so they knew it was C4. They found a piece of plastic with the residue on it and the hallmarks of bombing, so they knew the C4 had been in that, and they were able to identify a radio, a type of radio. They went out, they bought the radio, and they made bombs. They got luggage containers from Pan Am, and they filled them with the kind of, with luggage that we've all lost at the airports, have been misplaced, and then they blew them up. And when they were able to duplicate exactly the damage that was done to the luggage containers aboard Pan Am 103, they felt with great certainty that they knew where the bomb had been. In fact, they felt they feel they put that bomb on that airplane within 10 inches of where it is.
Is there anything else you can tell us about the investigation into the World Trade Center bombing that would help us understand the investigation that's happening now into the bombing in Oklahoma City?
These guys know what they're doing, the guys who are on the scene.
The FBI, you mean?
The FBI, the ATF. They know what they're looking for, and what they're going to do is they're going to attempt to put that bomb back together. And they're going to find bits and pieces that will lead them, or enable them, rather, to connect this bomb to the people who put it there. In the Van Pack bombings, in which several federal judges were bombed, the FBI crime lab metallurgical people were able to identify the machines in Europe on which the nails that were found in the bomb were made. Terrorism has come to the United States. This is not the last time this is going to happen. There is no complete way of protecting us from something like this. The one thing I would caution is that I know there are suspects. I know there's a lot of animosity out there already, and people are looking for vengeance. But I can tell you that the first suspects arrested, or at least believed, strongly believed to have committed the World Trade Center bombings, were Bosnians. And they turned out to have been criminals. They were running a diamond smuggling operation, in fact. But they, in fact, had absolutely nothing to do with that bombing.
David Fisher is the author of Hard Evidence. We spoke earlier today. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Roberta Shirock, with Alan Tu, Kathy Wolf, Nancy Updike, and Barbara Bogave. Research assistance from Becky Cohen. Our interns are Zeb Esselstyn and Sienna Chrisman. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from grants provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and from Living Language. Learn a new language at home or on the go with Living Language. This is NPR, National Public Radio.